Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to today's programme, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley, through till 4 o'clock this afternoon, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. You can find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And today we're going really to the main thing that we do week in, week out on this show, apologetics. And my guest, Chris Sinkinson, who joins us today, has a new book out called Confident Christianity. And listen out later on in the show, you can find out how you can win yourself a copy of the book. But right now, let's go into the show and meet today's guests and find out the topic.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, and today helping us to look at this is Chris Sinkinson. Been on the programme a couple of times last year. He's a church pastor, lecturer in Old Testament and apologetics at Moorlands Bible College. Well, his new book, Confident Christianity, is seeking to make apologetics accessible to normal Christians. So we're asking today, is apologetics a waste of time? And someone who suggests it is James Croft. He's a Brit studying at Harvard University in the US. He helps to lead his university humanist group. And his website, Temple of the Future, aims to revive and reimagine humanism for the 21st century. We're going to be hearing their discussion today here on the programme. Well, welcome along, gentlemen, both. James, thank you for getting up early to talk to us in the US. Thank you, Chris, for coming into the studio today.
Thank you.
Great to have you both here. James, we'll come to you in a moment because I think people who are regular listeners and particularly who have interacted on our online forums will be interested to know that you're on the programme today. But Chris, not the first time you've been with us, and last time was talking about the Bible, I think, wasn't
right.
it, with Leslie Scrace.
Yeah, I enjoyed that very much. The Unbeliever's Guide to the Bible.
That's right, The Unbeliever's called. Guide to the Bible. And before that, it was John Hick and
that's
Whether
right.
There Are Many Paths to God. And here you are with a new book. And I have to say, I've read it. I really, really enjoyed this book. I'd say that absolutely honestly.
Well, thank you, Justin.
It's not just, you know, words. And before we go into it, for those who maybe aren't familiar with you, though, tell us a bit of your background. You haven't always been a Christian, have you?
No, I was brought up going along to our local parish church, which I must say never really meant very much to me at the time. It was a matter of some tediousness, I thought, that I was dragged along to church, and certainly wouldn't have thought in terms of a personal faith in Christ. That would have seemed a very alien language to me. And as a later teenager, we begin to ask bigger questions about life. And I met Christians who were a little different than any that I'd met before. There was something quite unique about them, I thought. They formed a Christian union, so our local college. And I was just impressed that there was something they had that I didn't have. And really, it was through the witness of that Christian union. Actually, I met subsequently, a few years later, the leader of that Christian union. And I'd not seen him for years and years and years and years. And he remembered me as the awkward one who came along, which I didn't think I'd been. I mean, I was asking questions, but I didn't realize I'd been so awkward when I came and asked them. But anyway, they were very patient with me. And I think that was the sort of time when I came to a personal faith in Christ.
Right. And so you obviously had questions. And I'm sure, like many people, it's been a sort of a journey of both experience and a kind of the intellectual journey of coming to terms with some of those big questions that inevitably crop up in the course of life.
That's right. And I mean, I still have big questions and I enjoy big questions and thinking about big questions. I studied archaeology. That was the degree I first started to pursue. But I got tired with the idea that I was going to be spending every Saturday in a wet, rainy field in England. So I actually transferred to English and philosophy. And philosophy really inspired me, as did English literature, actually. But philosophy really inspired me that here was the opportunity to think about big questions. And I never felt particularly defensive about my faith, though I don't think Christianity was taken particularly seriously in the philosophy department where I was a student. But certainly I didn't feel defensive. I just found it a really interesting way of spending my time. And the idea of doing doctoral studies in, well, theology, but philosophy of religion was my background, really. It seemed like a great way of spending a few years. And so I got more and more interested in that area of exploring these questions, not because I necessarily felt defensive and I had to mount a defense of the Christian faith, but because these were the things that really made me tick, and these were the things that interested me.
Apologetics is sometimes a word that puts people off because it sounds unusual. Greek, for starters. And, but you've written a book about apologetics, but as far as I can see, you're trying to make it as accessible as possible.
That's right. Confident Christianity is aimed at, I think, a sort of mid-level book on apologetics. So it wouldn't be the first book somebody might read on the subject. But for someone who's thinking about these questions and coming across terms they haven't yet come to understand, or issues or things that happen perhaps in history they don't understand, this book might help them to take it on to another level. I would like to hope that that's going to be its value for people. And in terms of what apologetics is, well, you're right. I mean, the word itself is somewhat misleading, isn't it? I mean, we think about giving an apology because we've made
done
a mistake.
Something wrong.
But apologetics here is something much more robust, which is why I think the word confidence is correct. Something much more robust. It is the commendation, enthusiastic commendation of our faith. And that's something that I don't think Christians need to be embarrassed or apologetic in the wrong sense about. Mm. But we do need to be giving that kind of credible defence of our faith.
As I read it, I thought, I wish I could have read this book 6 years ago when I began this show, because I've essentially picked up my apologetics knowledge piecemeal over the years. But this book kind of really lays out the field quite clearly in terms of the different strands, the different thoughts that have been behind apologetics in the past, and the different, as it were, you know, areas that it impacts today. And I mean, for instance, a couple of years ago, we did for the first time a show specifically on presuppositional apologetics. And what I wasn't expecting on the back of that was just how divided a lot of the audience were on the value of presuppositional apologetics against evidential apologetics. Now, for those who are listening and going, what is presuppositional apologetics as opposed to evidential? You might need to explain that. But I mean, how, I suppose we can kind of get bogged down in the way we do it. Sometimes even losing sight of the purpose of it.
You're absolutely right. In the book, I try and summarise various approaches to apologetics in terms of just three headings, which is a little difficult because clearly you could divide them down into many, many more than that, and often sort of four or five different methods of apologetics are described. Well, I do that in order to try and simplify the issues and give people some access to what this debate is all about, why presuppositionalists are so adamant that evidentialism is misleading and vice versa. But having said that, you know, one of the key influences on me in getting more interested in apologetics was Francis Schaeffer and the works of Francis Schaeffer. I came across him while I was an undergraduate philosophy student. And it's not that I would say that Schaeffer got it all right on matters of philosophy or his interpretation of philosophers, but I was just really fascinated that here was a missionary, a pastor, somebody who loved people, engaging with intellectual ideas. And that kind of gave me the freedom to think, well, what I'm studying in philosophy, I don't need to keep in a box as a Christian. I can engage with these ideas, knowing that that's something that really we're called to do as Christians, to love God with all our mind as well as our heart. So Schaeffer really, I think, opened that up for me. And then that drew me into the Labrie Fellowship. And I stayed for a little while at Labrie Fellowship in the UK. And the vision of Labrie is that we are holistic beings. We're not just walking brains. And so while we can have intellectual questions that we want satisfied, also we spend time, if anyone stays at a Labrie house, they'll spend some of their time polishing floors or washing up or cutting the grass. Not because that just needs to be done, but because that's part of how God has made us. And it's part of our apologetics, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and for those who don't know what presuppositional apologetics is, in a nutshell, what is it as opposed to any other form of apologetic?
Well, evidentialism, let me start that way around. Evidentialism would assume that we essentially have a kind of neutral area of knowledge, evidences that we can share between Christians and non-Christians, that we can debate, and we can be on that kind of common ground with one another. The presuppositionalist raises the question, I think it's a very important question, of whether there really is such a thing as neutral knowledge, or in fact, do we already presuppose the things that matter most to us? And as Christians, I think we have to admit that we do have a very important contribution that our faith makes, a presupposition, if you like, either, I think in terms of Cornelius Van Til, that the Bible is the Word of God, a very well-defined presupposition, or more generally in terms of presuppositionalists, the presupposition that there is a God, that there is a God who made us, that we're in a God-created world. And rather than that being the end of a long argument using neutral evidences, that's the presupposition we have before we even see the evidence. Mm. In fact, the evidence doesn't make sense. Reason itself doesn't work unless we presuppose that we are made in the image of a God.
And I sometimes get the feeling from some presuppositional apologists that it's my way or no way. Do you see it as a both and yourself?
I certainly do. I think Francis Schaeffer, again, is very helpful here, and this is where his influence was important on me. Schaeffer parted company with the presuppositionists in many ways, so that's where he did his training. He trained under Cornelius Van Til. And the reason why Schaeffer parted company is he saw that our priority is really evangelism. It's witness, it's sharing our faith. And so we need to be quite pragmatic about our use of method. We shouldn't make method such an idol that we somehow can't deal with people as people. In the end, we're human beings. We share many concerns with all the people that we meet with, whether it's on the tube train or at school or at work. And because we share so much in common, I think we need to allow our methods to be helpful where necessary, but not to get in the way of communicating effectively.
Well, we're talking apologetics on the programme today, the defence of the Christian faith, both in the sense of defending the claims of Christianity and indeed critiquing the claims of other worldviews, I suppose. Confident Christianity is the name of Chris Sinkinson's new book. He's a church pastor. He's a lecturer at Moorlands Bible College. By the way, they've got a C.S. Lewis study day coming up in March. It's Saturday the 24th of March, so if you can get along to that, that's certainly worth doing, marking the 60th anniversary of the publication of Mere Christianity. But our other guest who's joining us from the States is James Croft. He's a Brit, but he's studying at Harvard University, helps to lead his university humanist group there, and his own website, Temple of the Future, is aiming to revive and reimagine humanism for the 21st century. That's a very big task you've got ahead of you there, isn't it, James?
I like Sisyphean tasks like that, yes.
James, tell us a bit about your background. You've been listening to the show for a few years, haven't you?
I have. I've enjoyed the show for many years, and I thought there were some interesting parallels between my background and what Chris shared about his, but I was interested to see that while I loved going to church as a child, although I never believed, he had to be dragged along. I started as a choir boy singing in my school choir, and people tell me they can still see the halo above my head occasionally. And I loved singing in the chapel choir. And I remember once going up to the altar to be blessed, which is something that I didn't normally do. And I watched as the vicar went down the row of boys with their heads bowed and placed his hand on each of them, and I could smell the incense in the air. And when he got to me, he put both his hands on my head and he pushed down really hard, as if he was trying to squeeze God in there. And I wondered, does he know I don't believe in any of this? Because I had been raised in a very happy non-religious home. We used to watch Star Trek and discuss the moral values that are inherent in it. They're sort of my parables. And I used to go to the planetarium with my grandfather and marvel at the beauty of the cosmos, no God included. And so I like to say that I'm raised on Shakespeare, Carl Sagan, and Star Trek. And when I got to university in my teenage years, I decided to find more about religion. And so I read the Bible, the Quran, the Mahabharata, which is still one of my favorite sets of stories, and a number of classic works of apologetics, like Who Moved the Stone and pieces like C.S. Lewis. And I've kept doing that. I recently read The Reason for God by Timothy Keller, for example, and also some works by religious mystics and others, because I was interested with mystical experience. And instead, I discovered works by people like William James, Abraham Maslow, and particularly the Humanist Manifestos. And when I read the Humanist Manifestos, which are sort of big documents describing what humanists believe, I saw myself, and I recognized that, in fact, I was and still am a humanist. And when I went to America, that just became stronger and stronger.
We'll talk more about this in a moment's time, but if you're listening and you'd like to perhaps put your voice into this conversation, send me an email, then why not do that? unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, I'm available on Twitter and Facebook as well, and enjoy interacting with those who tweet me and get in touch on the Facebook page, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account, and facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook account. All those links as well, and lots more available from the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
You certainly are. It's a show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon. Don't forget that, yes, you can get in touch, and we'll be reading out those emails later on in the programme from the past few weeks of programming. We're talking about apologetics today. Chris Sinkinson is church pastor and lecturer in Old Testament and apologetics at Moorlands Bible College. His new book, Confident Christianity, seeks to make apologetics accessible to normal Christians. Okay, James, let's start the conversation now then. You've obviously interacted with apologetics. You seem to be very open-minded as far as reading works from Christian authors in your search. And you've obviously interacted probably with quite a few Christians, you know, with some apologetics background on the internet forums and things that I've seen you on in the past. So what's your in all that time, what has been your general conclusion when it comes to apologetics, the defence of the Christian faith? Is it a waste of time as far as you're concerned?
Well, first I should probably say that I only think it's a waste of time in a very specific sense. I'm really impressed with Chris's engagement and passion about what he believes, and I'm equally passionate about what I believe. I've often been called an evangelical humanist by my friends who want to annoy me, and it really doesn't annoy me, because I am, I have a confident humanism, like Chris seems to have a confident Christianity. And I love, like Chris described, Francis Schaeffer engaging with people about these important ideas. So I don't think it's a waste of time to be passionate about what you believe and to try and convince people that what you believe is true. In fact, I think that's very important. I think where we part ways is in what we believe to be true. And my general feeling is, and I think it's interesting that Chris described his journey. This is what you said, Chris. I think I got it right. There was something they had, speaking of the Christians you met as a teenager, there was something they had that I didn't have. And you became a Christian because of that, and the rationalization for it came afterwards, if I understand you, which is how William Lane Craig and lots of other apologists also describe their faith journey. And I guess my feeling is that that's backwards. You really should have the evidence to support your position before you take it on, and not try and find the evidence after you've taken on the position for other reasons. And I generally feel that people aren't reasoned into or out of their faith. I think that they join a faith community, which they love, with people that they love, or they're raised in a faith community that's important to them for cultural and personal reasons. And then they try and fit the reasons around that, very understandably. But in my judgment, the reasons to accept the Christian faith, and the evidence particularly of the specific claims of the Christian faith, are simply nowhere near good enough for an impartial observer to accept.
Right, that's really interesting. So it's about rationalising something you've already believed for other reasons. But Chris?
Well, could I say, regarding sharing your testimonies, I'm sure you find, James, in sharing your testimony as your conversion to evangelical humanism, I think when we share a testimony, or when we share our journey, our story, we simplify. We simplify in order to draw out the main lines or a key event, perhaps, that will be memorable or will connect with the person we're speaking to. And I often think when we look back over a testimony, there are other ways that we could tell the story. There are other things that were going on. And as I look back over mine, of course, it's far more complicated than that. There's a network of things that are going on. I think the factor of people who show that Christianity is really something that works in their lives and makes sense of life is a very powerful evidence. But I also think that in conversation, being taken seriously, having certain questions answered at least satisfactorily at that point in life, that's very important. Having our imagination expanded. It's interesting, we've talked about C.S. Lewis, and I look back on my engagement with Lewis, and to be honest, Lewis spoke to me far more through the Narnia books when I became a Christian than mere Christianity. It was only actually after I'd become a Christian that mere Christianity became a book that was very helpful for me. But in terms of my conversion, I think Lewis and Tolkien and other writers expanded my imagination to think that there may be more to this universe than I might think by common sense. And so having expanded my imagination, it's then, you're right, many of the apologetic arguments and the reasoning began to put things into place. But, you know, I just think we simplify in a testimony. There are a web of things going on, and I think reasons and experience and encounters with other people all have their contribution.
It does raise the question, though, that often comes up in regard to apologetics about whether anyone can be reasoned into believing in God or believing in Christ more specifically. And a lot of people would raise their eyebrows at that, because surely you can't, as it were, just intellectually assent to something. Faith is more than that, isn't it?
Of course it is. And I think James is onto something there as well, that when we think about the role of apologetics, we should recognise there's a limitation in what we can achieve. I think reasoning somebody to faith in Christ would not be the way I'd understand the purpose of apologetics. Certainly reason can clear away some of the objections. It can clear away some of the barriers. It can begin a journey. I think apologetics is an ongoing part of the Christian life. And many people, I mean, myself included, tune into the Unbelievable show because these are questions we're still asking. And we're finding, you know, our minds are being made up as time goes by. So I don't think this is a chicken and egg kind of question. I don't think we can put one in front of the other and say this must be the sequence or the order in which these things follow.
James.
So I want to clarify what you're saying here, Chris, because I want to have a real discussion with you rather than imagine that I understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
When I don't. How severe is the limitation that you're talking about, the limitation of apologetics? If you say that it's not really for reasoning people into the Christian faith, are you saying, therefore, that the reasons for the Christian faith are inadequate to convince an impartial observer and that you have to really believe it beforehand?
I think in all matters of ultimate seriousness, there's an element of faith and assumption that is involved. And so reasons are important, and they can certainly clear away the objections. They can clear away problems that we had. And to a certain extent, I think apologetics is a matter of communicating more clearly. I mean, you're asking me to clarify, and in apologetics we find often in answering a question we clarify what we meant, and that's a very helpful thing to do. But in terms of faith in Christ, this is where I think presuppositionalism really is onto something. We do recognise
that... Oh, please,
that
no.
Okay, James. But
I wasn't prepared for that. Okay.
No, don't worry. I'm not taking a wholesale commitment to presuppositionalism into this show. But certainly I think the insight to presuppositionalism is that there are certain matters of ultimate commitment which involve faith, which do involve certain assumptions. They're not irrational, they're not anti-reason, but they go beyond where the reasons could take us. And that seems to me not just legitimate for my own views, but for your views too.
You know, I'm not sure that I accept that in quite the way you formulated it. I think that I could grant, and I'm not saying I do grant, but for the sake of argument, I could grant that there is something that we might call faith or some sort of presupposition that's required for any intellectual discussion to begin. But that does not mean that all presuppositions are equally reasonable to make. And that's a critical point that presuppositionalism really doesn't deal with adequately, in my view. Because even if I accept that there are some presuppositions we all need to make to start a discussion on something, there are some presuppositions that are more reasonable than others, and there are some positions that require more presuppositions, however reasonable they are, than other positions. And it seems to me that the theistic position, and particularly the Christian theistic position, requires rather a lot of very improbable presuppositions in comparison to the naturalist position, which, if it may require some presuppositions, requires fewer of them and they're more reasonable.
Well, that's not been my experience. Obviously, that's been your experience. I think when we talk about... Let's remove the word presuppositionism from it for a moment, if we may. But when we talk about faith, then I think we are all people of faith to some extent. We will have faith in certain beliefs and ideas and in certain people, and we live our lives day by day with faith as a very important part of what we do in life.
What you mean by faith? I'm sorry to interrupt there, but
Very simply, a faith would mean trust, and some sense of trust in those things which go beyond what we might be able to logically explain or provide evidence for or reasons for. We may, in retrospect, be able to provide evidence for our trust, our faith, but actually we live our lives day by day without a fully drawn up epistemology or philosophical case for what we do with our lives. We live our lives on the basis of faith, and that can be put to the test in various ways, but nonetheless we are all people of faith to some extent. I mean, you would accept that, James, that there are faith commitments that you would have in your humanist position.
I wouldn't call them faith commitments, and I think there's a real difficulty here with how you're using the term faith, because many of the listeners to this program will understand that term in a very different way to the way that you have used it. They won't use it as synonymous with trust, like I have faith in God the way that I trust someone is going to pay me for a service I've rendered them, for example. They use faith to mean a very specific sort of belief that is in the realm of religion or supernaturalism that has particular characteristics that trust doesn't have. So I think there's an equivocation fallacy here right off the bat, which serves your argument, but it doesn't serve honest discourse around this.
Well, just to clarify faith, the word faith simply does mean trust. I mean, this is the etymology of the word. And
That's an etymological fallacy.
We do use this word in many areas of life. We use the word faith to describe it in many ways, our trust in certain an aeroplane to hold us up. We trust in terms of our basic beliefs, our beliefs in other minds, our beliefs that history is real and not simply something that appeared 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age. In many different areas, we use, yes, trust. We trust in a common sense realism. This is true of many areas of life. Now, okay, I mean, I'm using the word faith simply to be able to widen the stage from talking about Christian theism to talking about all belief systems. You're right,
yes.
I'm widening the word.
And I'm challenging your widening of that stage. So let's find another word about faith.
You give me another word, James.
I will in a second. I think your example of an aeroplane to hold us up is very interesting, because I don't think most people would say that it is a faith-based position to believe that an aeroplane will function as it is designed, because we can specify exactly why it is, in theory and in principle and in practice, an aeroplane will fly rather than fall to the ground. But that's not the case with a position like the existence of God. You can't specify to the same level of mechanistic detail exactly why a God belief is reasonable in comparison to a non-God belief. And I think that by calling them both faith, you smooth over legitimate differences that are difficult for your argument to deal with. And so what I would call, instead of faith, I would call reasonable belief, for example, or justified belief. And we have a justified belief in aeroplanes to hold us up, but we might have faith in something like a God, which, as you've accepted, is something that we can't fully reason our way toward, that there's some additional a move that we have to make that isn't entirely based on reason, like our belief in planes is based on reason.
We're going to take a quick break. Chris will be back to respond to James Croft, who's on the line from the States, Brit studying at Harvard University. We're asking, though, Chris has written a book called Confident Christianity, seeking to make apologetics more accessible to normal Christians. And he'll be responding, Chris Inkinson, that is, to James, who is our atheist on the programme today, as we ask, is apologetics a waste of time? Here on the show that aims to get you thinking, Unbelievable, back after a very short break.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Fascinating topic today, which really kind of drills down into kind of what the bread and butter of this show is on a week-to-week basis. Apologetics, the defence of the Christian faith, and really looking at what it means to do apologetics, what the value is of apologetics. And helping us to drill down is Chris Sinkinson, church pastor and lecturer at Moorlands Bible College. His new book, Confident Christianity, is seeking to make apologetics a little bit more accessible to Christians. And as he said in the introduction, perhaps a mid-level kind of book for those who've maybe dipped their toe in, want to find a bit more about the background, the methodology of apologetics, presenting the Christian faith as an intellectually viable option. James Croft has certainly looked at apologetics with an open mind, he says, and he says he hasn't been convinced. He's an atheist, he's a humanist, he's out in the States at Harvard University, and he's talking to Chris this afternoon about whether apologetics is a waste of time, and we continue the conversation now. So in that last section, Chris, James put the case to you that you're equivocating a little bit there, that trust in an aeroplane won't fall out of the sky suddenly is not the same as trust in God, faith in God. So it is possible, he says, to see that there are some positions of trust which are more rational than other positions of trust, and that we don't have to presuppose, you know, it's more rational for James to presuppose a naturalistic view of the universe than a theistic view of the universe.
And, of course, I've been accused of the equivocation fallacy, so I must make my defence. And also point out that if listeners... That's OK, James. If listeners would like to find out more about how some of these fallacies work, I do describe them in my book.
Yes,
in one
do.
Chapter, and hopefully encourage Christians to avoid them. So I must defend myself on this charge.
OK.
So what I'm suggesting with the word faith is that rather than leave that as a fuzzy word, which it can often be in discussions, and of course if we want to talk about the way in which a word is misused, I think Richard Dawkins is a great example of somebody who uses faith to mean what is irrational or non-reason, and he opposes faith and reason in various places in his works and in his books. Now what I would like to do is to actually turn that around and suggest that actually we're all human beings. We have a great deal in common, and one of the things that we do have in common is that there are certain assumptions that we do have to make. That doesn't mean we're being irrational and non-reasonable, because we can test those assumptions. They can make sense. We might want to call that common sense, in keeping with a certain Scottish movement in philosophy. And that testing of our faith, which I think is common to humanity, is something that we can do through apologetics. We can test whether what we believe is really true. Take belief in God, which I would hold as a basic belief. I think belief in God is something which is quite natural to us. And in believing in God, it doesn't mean that I can describe every dimension of this mysterious being who is obviously going to be far beyond my simple understanding. And in terms of the doctrine of the Trinity, I'd recognize there are aspects of the Trinity very hard to explain or to rationalize. But nonetheless, that belief in the Trinity or in the God of Christian theism is not irrational. It doesn't go in the face of faith. It doesn't fly in the face of reason, I should say.
James, obviously, you've when Chris brought up the subject of presuppositionalism, you sort of groaned. This is because I think you've interacted on this subject a bit in the past. I mean, I wanted to maybe move us into the area of what your interactions have been like when you have run into those who are, as it were, immersed in the apologetics. I mean, have they been helpful, constructive, or do you find them a waste of time generally in terms of trying to get to a better understanding of things?
That's a difficult question to answer. It depends a lot on who the people you are discussing with are. Sometimes I find it very intellectually invigorating, like this discussion is very interesting. Sometimes it's extremely infuriating, because people pull the same sorts of tricks and make the same arguments that have been discredited over and over again. And if I had to make a criticism of apologetics as a field from my limited knowledge of it, I do see the very same discredited arguments repeated again and again and again, and defeated again and again and again. And I do have to ask at a certain point about the intellectual integrity of people who are willing to present in debate after debate after debate arguments that have clearly been discredited. I think that there's a moral question there about, if you're trying to convince someone that something is true and you continually use arguments for which very convincing counter-arguments have been proposed without taking into account those counter-arguments, I think you're doing something intellectually dishonest. And sometimes, at its worst, I think apologetics is like that. But there's another danger, which I think we may be falling into now, which is getting caught up in minutiae about definitions of terms and avoiding really big questions that are significant problems for apologists. but that they're very good at avoiding. So, for example, I would love, I'm not saying that Chris is attempting to avoid this, but we have, our discussion has gone a different way. I would love to know, for example, how Chris would encourage me to believe that the resurrection of Jesus actually occurred. Because I believe, Chris, that you think that that was a historical event, and I remember, or I heard you say on another talk of yours that I listened to, that you believe in what you called a scientific history, and that you should therefore be able to provide evidence for that that might convince me, a non-believer, that that particular historic event occurred. I don't see how you could possibly do that, and I'd be fascinated to talk about that, because really, I could grant that God exists, and you still have a long way to go to convince me that Christianity is the correct expression of that God.
Well, there's 2 points there, and it would be interesting to tackle both of them if we can. Firstly, this point about whether apologists are guilty of bringing up the same argument that's been discredited. Now, this came up quite a bit, obviously, when we were having our William Lane Craig Fest back in October.
And
I think you and others, James, were suggesting that he keeps bringing the same arguments, and we do hear essentially the same 4 or 5 arguments from Craig in his debates, but they've been disproved. And I think from his perspective, he says, well, tell me these disproofs and I will then answer them, but I have to be able to present the case, as it were, fresh each time I debate. I mean, can you see the value in that, or do you think that the problem is the debate format, which, as it were, always starts from scratch again each time?
No, that's not a legitimate response at all. If your arguments have been defeated, it's your moral responsibility, and I put
but
it.
He would
in that
obviously disagree that his arguments
absolutely
have been defeated. That's the problem.
Well,
James,
I think yes.
Sorry, James, carry on.
Please. No, please go ahead.
If I could interrupt.
We're so polite today. It's wonderful. What an incredibly polite show.
This is a very British show. Sorry, I mustn't say that, must I? James, when you pointed out the issue of history and scientific history, that's actually very helpful. I think that's sharpening up what I'm trying to say about the nature of faith. Because, yes, if we were to have a discussion about the resurrection of Christ, I probably would sound a little like some of the other apologists that you've heard, perhaps not as eloquent, but I would offer similar arguments. But what I'm doing in talking about the resurrection is showing how the things that we know from history fit with what we read in the Gospels or in the Bible. Things that we know from history don't contradict what we read in the Bible. They demand an explanation, an interpretation. I would suggest the interpretation of Christ's bodily resurrection is the most adequate explanation, it's the best explanation of the evidence that we have. Now, I'd actually say the same thing when I look at the whole of the biblical material, that we can compare it to historical records, that we can test it, weigh it up. That doesn't prove the Bible's true, because that is where this issue of faith is going to come in. But it can show that it's sound, that it's adequate, that it's a reasonable explanation. And I think when you're describing the arguments of Lane Craig as having been defeated, I think that's unfair, because obviously in matters of history, there are going to be differences of view as to what is the best explanation. There's a book published a few years ago by David Clark called Person-Centered Apologetics, which I think is quite a helpful term, because of course we are people. We have different priorities. We put different weightings on certain interpretations or certain pieces of evidence. What I will be bowled over by, perhaps a fine-tuning argument, an argument for design, I might find that very striking and appealing and intuitively very appealing, whereas I imagine you might find that a very weak argument and feel that it's been defeated. And that's because we're human beings, we're interpreting the evidence, and we put different weight on the things that we hear and read about. Can I just a moment more on the history of the Bible? I'm involved in some of the archaeology that's going on right now in Israel, and what I find very interesting is that among archaeologists in Israel, there's enormous range of different interpretations being offered for the evidence. This isn't between believers and non-believers, this is just among secular archaeologists. There's a huge swathe of different interpretations of how valuable the evidence is or what it points to. So that indicates to me that the evidence does not just stand alone, that there is a human element in what weight we give to the value of certain arguments.
I was going to say, and I do come in on this, James, that I mean, do we ever come to these things with a neutral position? No, surely not. I mean, I am a Christian, and I really want Christianity to be true. I really want there to be a God. You, James, are an atheist, I mean, do you say that, no, I really do have a neutral position and am willing to be persuaded either way by the evidence? Or is it fair to say that you don't actually really want there to be a God and you don't really want Christianity to be true, and so you will perhaps be more dogged in your pursuing the counter-arguments, let's say, to Christian apologetics?
Well, first I would say that I am certainly subject, as all human beings are subject, to cognitive biases, which means that I will prioritise arguments that support my position and deprioritise arguments that do not support my position. That's been demonstrated in many psychological studies that human beings, even if they're aware that they do that, still do it. And it's extremely difficult to get away from that bias. But that's why we have communities of inquiry with rules and collective standards for determining what the truth is. And Chris knows this as an archaeologist and historian and philosopher. He knows that there are rules that philosophers, for example, have come up with to determine what counts as a valid argument. And they police those rules as a community, so no one individual has the final say, exactly to get around this problem of individual bias. So I'm not claiming to have no personal bias, and nor is my argument that people like Craig or that Chris have personal bias. What I'm claiming is that arguments and evidence are inadequate according to the standards of the disciplines that they're using to make them, which is a totally different sort of claim. It's irrelevant. The personal bias is irrelevant. And what I really was surprised by in what Chris just said is that some arguments will resonate with us more than other arguments. So an argument that seems strong to Chris might seem weak to me, and that's kind of all right, as if we're choosing arguments like sweets in a sweet shop. I think that's a very, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but it's an intellectually irresponsible position, for particularly for a philosopher to take. Arguments are not strong or weak depending on our preference. Certainly we have preferences, but we have to use the collective frameworks that we've come up with to determine the truth to mitigate against our preferences and our biases and to try and come up with the truth. And so that's why I ask again whether he has any evidence that he thinks will convince me according to the standards of the disciplines involved.
Well, James, you're right about philosophy offering rules for discourse and rules for trying to describe what would count as a valid argument. That's absolutely right. But you and I also both know, because of the circles that we've moved in, that among philosophers there's a wide range of different views and opinions and beliefs and views of which arguments are really the ones that will be back of the net. You know, we both know that among philosophers there's a great number of Christian philosophers who are doing good, important work. Richard Swinburne, Paul Helm, Alvin Plantinga, the list could go on. And of course, then we could.
I don't deny that.
Yeah, and then of course, we can show that there are many philosophers who would then take an alternative position. And among those philosophers, while there might be agreement on some of the rules that are being used, and there have been over many centuries, the relative weight given to certain arguments is clearly different. There must be some other reason why those arguments work for some and don't work for others. And it's the same in history, it's the same in archaeology, that the evidence will have to be interpreted, it will have to be put into a framework. And right now, in terms of the archaeology of the Bible, there's quite a large swathe of opinion that's moving towards a more traditional, perhaps, or maximal view of the evidence for the Old Testament. And yet the same evidence is being read by other archaeologists who are very sceptical of this, offering a very minimal reading of that archaeological evidence. So the evidence in and of itself isn't the persuasive factor. It's obviously the evidence plus the interpretation of that evidence.
So you're putting a lot of weight, Chris, on this interpretive framework that you say that everyone brings to the evidence, if I understand you correctly. And I think that's true. We do come to evidence with interpretive frameworks. But firstly, there's just two things about this. Firstly, we can judge the quality of our interpretive frameworks. We come to something with a set of lenses, as it were, but we can take off our glasses to some extent and clean them up a bit if they look a little dirty and then put them back on, or get a new prescription if they're not working. We can change the frameworks through which we look at evidence, and I would say that the naturalist framework is the most convincing. It's the best set of glasses that we have. And the second thing that I would say here is that it does seem to me that you're rather conceding, and you seem to have conceded a number of times that, in fact, apologetics is not going to achieve at least what I understood to be one of its goals, which is the goal, for example, of the book The Reason for God that I have next to me, is the goal of some of the apologetics books that I read as a teenager, that it actually won't convince, on the basis of rational argument and evidence alone, people to become Christians who are not already Christians. And if you're conceding that, I rather think that my case is made. I don't really think you have much more to say if you say that, in fact, the evidence is not convincing on its own.
I don't think the evidence is convincing on its own, because I do recognise the human factor in how we evaluate that evidence. I don't think that's a particularly controversial statement to make. James, I mean, I'd had a look through your website, and this might be interesting just to put the issue this way around. And I found it a very interesting website, The Temple of the Future. I found it quite fascinating to read what you're trying to do. I found that very interesting. But the humanist values that you have seem to me to be dependent on a Christian background, which provides for a framework for morality and for community and for values, which, I mean, I really want to echo. I found that some of the values and the vision that you have there is something which, as a pastor of a church, you know, I want to create a community where we are involved in bringing salt and light in many different ways to a needy world, and where we're trying to meet heart and mind through so many different ministries that we may have. And it's interesting you called it Temple of the Future, you know, obviously the very religious kind of a symbolism and echoes in your own thinking there. Now, I read all of that and I say, where in terms of naturalism is the basis for these convictions and this vision that you have? I can relate my vision and my convictions to evidence that I can share with you. We've mentioned in passing evidence from design, the intuitive fine-tuning argument, the moral argument we may want to make, many different areas in which I think there is evidence for the existence of God and for the validity of the Christian message, the Christian worldview. And on that basis, I have this vision for community and for the difference we can make in the world. But reading your website, what would your convictions be based upon?
Well, first, I just want to make a meta point, as it were, which is very interesting that now the questions are being asked of me. And I think it's appropriate that I should be asked to justify my position. But it seems very interesting that at the moment you very clearly concede that reasons and evidence are insufficient to support your Christian point of view on their own, which I agree with, and I again say I think that my case is made.
Well, I'm not conceding. I mean, you're putting words into my mouth. I mean, what I'm conceding is that all of us bring interpretation to the evidence, that the evidence doesn't stand alone. That's all I'm conceding. I mean, that's the position that we're all in.
I'm sorry, I need to clarify that then. I did understand you as saying not just that the evidence doesn't stand alone, but that the evidence alone is insufficient, which is not quite the same.
That the evidence requires interpretation.
I mean, if you were saying the evidence alone is sufficient, and every reasonable person should therefore be convinced by the evidence, then presumably, and if Tim Keller is saying that and other apologists are saying that, then they should also expect every person who picks up their book to become a Christian by the time they put it down. Obviously, they're not expecting that to happen. So, I can only assume, though, that they would agree with Chris, actually, that you will read the same evidence and you may come away still not convinced because your interpretation will differ from mine. But it doesn't mean that, therefore, my interpretation is unreasonable, therefore.
Well, that would make the Christian claim to be something other than a claim to truth. Because if I say to you, here is the evidence that an aeroplane will hold us up, and you read the evidence and fully understand it and come away still believing that it won't, you are in error. And you are being unreasonable, and it's quite reasonable to say that. It doesn't seem to me to be a stretch. I think most people would agree that it's unreasonable to deny the evidence in that case. But if we're saying that whether Christianity is true or not depends upon your interpretation of the evidence, and that it is possible to be a reasonable person and to be presented with the evidence and to understand the evidence and to still not be a Christian, then it seems to me it's impossible to make the claim that Christianity is true.
Well, James, I don't see how it follows, because I cannot believe for one minute that you would seriously mean that the only reasonable people at Harvard University are those who agree with you. I mean, you know, I recognise that you're a reasonable person. I think that you are a reasonable person. I think there may be other reasons, not simply to do with evidence, for why you don't believe in God or why you don't believe in the God of Christianity. You know, obviously I'm not entirely sure of your position, but I don't think it's just about evidence and reason in your position. And surely you would agree with me that, I mean, taking Harvard University as an example, there are going to be many, many reasonable people who disagree with you.
I think this is a very difficult point to respond to, and I'm glad Chris raised it, because it's very difficult to say what I'm about to say without sounding extraordinarily arrogant or unfair to my religious colleagues, who I respect a huge amount. I do think it is possible to be a reasonable person and be a religious person at the same time. But I do think that it is unreasonable to hold the belief that, for example, Jesus Christ rose from the dead. I do not believe you can be a believer in the inerrancy of the Bible, as I believe Chris is, and be reasonable about that. That, I think, is simply an unreasonable position. There is not sufficient evidence to support it. And I say with the greatest respect to people who believe that, they don't have good reasons for it. And I think your listeners will note that no good reasons have been presented in this discussion as to why I should believe that.
Okay, well, James, I mean, the reasons which I would want to give would be, again, as I've mentioned, the intuitive value of the design argument, fine-tuning, the moral argument. I think the resurrection is historically something which we can test. What I think you've already said, though, is you've already declared in advance that you've heard all these arguments and that these will not convince you. And so that's why, rather than giving you, you know, the details of those arguments again, we've really developed this kind of a meta question, which is, must we, to be reasonable, take the humanist rationalist position? And this is clearly patently not true. It's not just religious people who would disagree with you. I mean, there are scientists, educators, people involved in the humanities who would have quite different views on the values of various arguments and have various different beliefs. And it's not that they are irrational, it's just that they do have a different interpretive grid that they're using to apply to the evidence. And I just can't see how you could possibly disagree with that point. I mean, this is not just about religious people and the rationalist humanists. I mean, there are non-Christian scientists who would see great value in many of the different arguments and ideas that we Christians would also share.
Well, I guess it's strange that I should have to remind you of this, Chris, because it should be the other way around. But I want to remind you of the nature of the Christian claim. The Christian claim is not some interpretive framework through which we might view the world. It is the claim that Jesus Christ died and was risen again and will ascend up to heaven and will return to judge the living and the dead. That's the claim of Christianity. It is a moral claim that has profound impact on how I live my life.
And that's where I would want to
believe
say,
that. This is need to provide strong evidence.
And the evidence that I would provide, which I think you've already said that you would not find persuasive, is the evidence of historical arguments that we can produce to show that the reasonableness of believing clearly in an empty tomb, trying to explain what happened on the third day, evidence that this is not simply to be explained away as an hallucination or as the disciples
stealing
the body. You know these arguments.
Claim.
And what I'm trying to look at
is
why some people find these arguments, and many people do, absolutely persuasive that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. That can be on the basis of historical evidence. It can be on the basis of personal experience of Christ today living in our lives, the existence of the church. Where did the church come from? How to explain its existence, its growth, its rapid spread? We could look at all these different areas and avenues, which I'm very happy to do with you, but I think you've already declared that you will not be persuaded of these arguments.
No, I think I should clarify. I haven't declared that I will not be persuaded. I have declared that I have not been persuaded, which is not the same thing. There's an implication or a suggestion in what you're saying that I am unpersuadable, which I do not think is true. I think that if sufficient evidence were provided to me, for example of, let's stick to this specific claim, of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, if people could prove to me that it happened, well, let's take away proof. I won't even ask proof. I'll ask if people can show me that it is reasonable to believe that Christ was risen instead of something else that could plausibly have happened. If you could prove to show me just that, it would be a step.
But I'm absolutely convinced that that can be shown, that it is reasonable to believe that Christ rose from the dead.
So what evidence would you draw?
I would look at normal historical evidences, the evidences that we would use to weigh up any historical event, and we can see that there is reliable testimony from eyewitnesses and those who recorded the evidence of eyewitnesses, that the tomb was empty, that Christ appeared on the third day, that this cannot be explained away as an hallucination or as a conspiracy theory.
Why can it not be explained away as
a hallucination? Well, how would you explain it away? How would you explain away the evidence that we have, which is the very earliest levels of the historical records in the New Testament, not talking necessarily about the Gospels initially.
I'm not going to contest that, Chris. I'm going to do you a great favour here for the purpose of our discussion, and I am going to grant that these are eyewitness testimonies that are in themselves reliable. Okay, I don't believe that, but I'm going to grant it for the purpose of this discussion. Now, let's say that we have four fantastic corroboratory eyewitness testimonies that say that they saw an empty tomb and then later they saw...
I mean, far more than four. We have to take the whole of the New Testament and evidence like 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which would probably be one of the earlier strands.
You can have them all.
Okay,
I'm saying to you that is not sufficient evidence to believe such an extreme claim.
So you're taking David Hume's kind of view that is essentially telling me that for an extraordinary claim, extraordinary evidence needs to be provided. Would that be fair?
I am saying that, yes, evidence... I guess I would ask your listeners to consider this. If I claim to you now that I am speaking on this program simply because after being dead this morning, I came alive again, they would ask for quite some evidence to support that. And no amount of eyewitness testimonies would be sufficient, I think, to convince you that that was true.
We are going to... I'm so sorry, Giles, to butt in again, but we're going to take another break. Fascinating conversation as we've delved into a specific of, obviously, the claim of Christian apologetics, the resurrection of Christ, pretty fundamental one. Is the evidence enough? And should the non-Christian be persuaded simply on the basis of the evidence alone and in regard to the resurrection of Christ? Come back in just a few moments' time. We're going to be continuing this conversation and starting to conclude it as well on the show that aims to get you thinking as we ask, is apologetics a waste of time here on Unbelievable? Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley here for the last part of our discussion today on whether apologetics makes any sense, whether it's a waste of time. Back to our guests Chris Sinkinson and James Croft in just a moment's time. If you're listening next week, do come back for the Common English Bible. We're going to be looking at a new translation of the Bible, asking, do we need another translation of the Bible? We'll be hearing from Joel Green, who is one of the heads of translation for the New Testament for the Common English Bible, finding out about it. Some of the interesting, unusual choices of translation as he interacts with David Stone Brewer, who's on the board of the New International Version, and so really an in-depth look at why Bible translators choose to translate things in certain ways, and some of your input that I asked for recently on that program next week as well. Now, I mentioned earlier on that we are giving away some copies of Chris Sinkinson's book that we've been hearing about today, Confident Christianity. Well, if you want to get hold of a copy, here's what to do. Just tell me what makes you believe, or if you're listening and you want a copy and you're not a believer, what makes you not believe? I'll put all the answers that come in into a hat, and I'll choose five for the book giveaway. Five copies available of that. So do email me with what makes you believe or not to unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll also accept entries on our Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or via Twitter @unbelievablejb, okay, and send those in the next week or so, and I'll choose some winners on next week's show. So thank you very much. That's the way to do it. Right now, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So tying up today's discussion on whether apologetics is a waste of time, we've had in the studio with me Chris Sinkinson, church pastor and lecturer at Moreland Bible College. Just a reminder as well that their C.S. Lewis Study Day, marking the 60th anniversary of the publication of Mere Christianity, comes up on Saturday the 24th of March. Check out moreland.ac.uk for more details about that. Some great speakers coming along for that, and a special play going on as well, which you can find out more about there. But today's topic has been on the whole area of apologetics, and I can't remember now who had the last word in that last section, guys.
I think James told me he may have been raised from the dead. Was that right?
James, essentially you've been sort of making this point that you don't believe that there's enough, the evidence is good enough to convince someone, however neutral they may be, that Christianity is, you know, the claims of Christianity are true. Chris has been saying the evidence is good enough, but from what I'm hearing, Chris, you're saying obviously whether we are willing to accept the implications of that evidence does depend on the previous commitments we come to it with to some extent, and that we shouldn't deny that. And James, you said, well, that does make it very different then to whether there's evidence that a Boeing 747 will stay in the air because of the physics of flight. So where have we got to on this?
That was a very good summary.
Thank you. I think that the claim that James made, that there could be a similar requirement in terms of defeating the belief that he's risen from the dead himself, I think this is just not a fair comparison at all. Certainly, if James were to make that claim, then I would want to know what the evidence is, and I would see whether that's stacked up like the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus does. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is solid. There's historical evidence that we can test by normal historical methods. There's the experience of believers today, but also the existence of the church itself. There are many different ways in which we can test whether this happened or not. Now, I accept entirely that James may rationally choose not to believe that interpretation of the evidence. He may say, no, the jury's out. We just don't know what happened 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem. I would, you know, entirely respect his decision to refuse to commit. But certainly the alternative explanations, which is where we raise those possibilities of hallucination or a conspiracy, I don't think those add up. I don't think those adequately deal with the evidence that we have.
James, a quick response and we'll move on.
Yes, I slightly resent the suggestion that this would, that my lack of being convinced would be due to a decision to refuse to commit. Quite the opposite. It is a decision to stick to principles of evidence and standards of evidence that are very standard in historical, in this case, historical inquiry. And it's striking that Chris has repeated time and time again that there's all this wonderful historical evidence that would stand up to historical scrutiny that Jesus Christ was in fact resurrected from the dead, but is not able to provide a single actual example of any such evidence that would be convincing. If that was true, Chris, let me just ask this question, because I think it's important. If it were true that the evidence was so convincing by the standards of historical decision-making that Christ was in fact raised from the dead, then why is it that the vast majority of professional historians do not believe that? Are they all deciding not to commit, or is it possible that you're the one who's decided to commit a priori and now are fitting the evidence around your beliefs, just like you suggested at the beginning you were?
But this kind of way of dealing with the subject doesn't work, because, of course, we could say, well, historically, for 2,000 years, the vast majority have come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, if we just wanted to use numbers, though, I think that makes my point, which is that the evidence in and of itself does need to be evaluated and weighed up. I find myself, as I look at this evidence, and the evidence, James, I mean, you know what I'm referring to here. It's the historical evidence that we find in the Gospel accounts, in the New Testament accounts, from outside of the New Testament, and in terms of the impact of this message that a man had come back to life again, the stunning, in terms of a first century Jewish context, the stunning message that a man in that context had claimed to be God and had been raised from the dead.
If I could come in at this, obviously, I think it may be slightly unfair to ask Chris to produce a full evidential case in the context of this program, where obviously we're talking in more general terms. But obviously, when we have done those programs dedicated to evidence for the resurrection of Christ, which I'm sure you listened to a couple of, James, what I've often found is that when a Bart Ehrman or a James Crossley has been debating that with the Christian historian, they might be willing to concede actually quite a lot in terms of the historical evidence, the point at which they say no, it's not admissible, is because it involves a faith claim ultimately, that it has a faith implication. Let's say, obviously, if the best explanation is that Jesus was raised from dead by God, that is not history, they say, that becomes theology. And so it's a kind of a priori thing that rules it out. And for me, it's is that the issue, really, that when we come to the historical evidence, it is actually ultimately about whether you're willing to admit a supernatural claims even as the best explanation in the first place?
No, that's not my problem actually at all. I do think that when those arguments are made by non-religious people, they are drawing essentially on a form of noma, on non-overlapping magisteria, or some form of a priori commitment to naturalism that's not necessarily legitimate. I think that there are, in principle, ways that I can imagine that I would be convinced that someone came back to life after being dead for 3 days. Let's put aside the supernatural claim, just that. I could be convinced. And I can tell you exactly what sorts of evidence would convince me. I would have to see detailed medical records. I would probably have to be in the room with the corpse on the slab. I would have to be observing it all the time. I'd have to be surrounded by medical professionals. That's the sort of evidence that I'm talking about that would convince me of an extraordinary claim of that sort. Now, whether that has supernatural faith implications, we can discuss after we've established the truth of the actual event, but there's nothing like that sort of evidence to support the claim that Christ was resurrected. And frankly, even a very large number of testimonies to the fact that it happened would not and does not convince me, and it shouldn't convince any reasonable person. There are currently on this planet tens of millions of people who believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet, who wrote down on golden tablets the truth dictated to him by the angel Moroni. Well, that was only happened 200 years ago. This demonstrates that human beings are capable of believing in things. I presume Chris does not believe that. Believing in things for which there is very little evidence. And it seems to me that the evidence to support Joseph Smith's claims are just as strong as the evidence to support the claims about the resurrection.
Well, not for one moment, but I think there's a comparison, really, in terms of the value of the evidence. Most historians, I think, would accept the basic claims of the existence of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus, that there was an empty tomb, and that in that period, that initial period, there was a claim that Jesus had been seen risen from the dead. That's a fair reading of the history. Now, of course,
I grant all that. I can grant it.
That would be the historical evidence, and then the next stage is, this is where I don't think we can argue
Precisely.
Somebody into the kingdom. The next stage is, well, what do we do with that evidence? How do we interpret that evidence? I think that what you want to do is to say, well, we just cannot know.
We are going to have to draw things to a close, guys, and we didn't get to something that obviously came up in the previous part of the programme when you were starting to put the questions to James there, Chris, about the foundations of his humanistic beliefs. But hey, maybe we'll come back to that another time. It's not as though we never discuss those sorts of things on the programme anyway. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, just have a look through the Unbelievable archives and you'll find all kinds of programmes along those lines. James, thank you so much. You have been such a good find, as it were, for interacting on this, because it's evident that you've really thought through these issues and you've obviously come...
I've enjoyed it very much.
Yes.
Me too. Thank you so much, Chris and Justin. I really appreciate it.
Been great to have you on. I'm sure we'll bring you on again at some unearthly hour of the morning in the States. But thank you for coming on.
James, can I send you a copy of my book? Would that be okay?
I would love to read a copy of your book, Chris. I would absolutely, it would be delightful.
We'll pursue it by email. That would be great. Thank you.
Great.
Great stuff. And if you want to get yourself a copy of Chris's book, he can't send them out free to everyone, I'm afraid, or else he wouldn't make any money out of it. Though I'm sure it's not a money-making thing at the end of the day. But it is available through all the normal methods, online, etc. And we'll post the links for how you can get hold of the book, Confident Christianity, by Chris Sinkinson, who was my Christian guest on the programme today. James Croft was our atheist humanist studying out at Harvard University. You can find out more about his organisation, Temple of the Future, online, and I'm going to post links to both my guests and all the information with the podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. In the meantime, thank you very much, both gentlemen, and look forward to speaking to you again sometime soon. If you're listening and you've been in touch, well, you might hear your words read out in a short moment's time as we look at some of the feedback to the last few weeks of programming.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you enjoy today's discussion. It's given you some food for thought, and it's good to sometimes, you know, get to grips with the basics of why we do these kinds of discussions on the radio station, why we have an apologetics debate show like this. If you want to get in touch, as I've said earlier, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing your response to this as well on our Facebook page, the Twitter account as well. You can find links to that from the webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And don't forget, you can get in touch via Twitter and Facebook and indeed email in order to enter the competition we're running, giving away 5 copies of the book, Confident Christianity by Chris Sinkinson. If you'd like to get a copy, just tell me what makes you believe, or not, as the case may be. I'm guessing this competition is going to mainly be of interest to Christians who want to get hold of the book, but if you're not a Christian, you're equally welcome to enter. I'm not at all putting any conditions on it like that. So what makes you believe or not, email it into me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or find the Facebook link and tell me that way, or equally you can send it to my Twitter account @unbelievablejb, and we'll draw 5 winners on the programme next week. Okay, I want to tell you about something that's coming up soon as well. Here's something that happened last year.
God gave us minds. I never accept that there's anyone in this world who cannot think. You need to start using what you've got on in your head. You need to start really living out your Christian faith.
Over 9 hours of teaching, 5 key speakers, all on one DVD. Unbelievable. The Conference. Get honest answers to tough questions at premier.org.uk/DVD.
Yes, the DVD available. If you don't have a copy, why not? It's an excellent resource for anyone interested in apologetics. And if you're listening to this programme, your interest may have been sparked a little in investigating some of the questions that the area of apologetics raises in regard to the Christian faith. So it's a great DVD, literally almost 10 hours of teaching and seminar material on that DVD, recorded at the Unbelievable Conference last year. Good news is we are doing another Unbelievable Conference. I'm going to be giving you full details of it at the end of February, okay, just about 3 months before the conference happens. Conference scheduled for Saturday the 26th of May. So if you are someone who likes to book well ahead, circle that date in your diary, and I'm going to give you full details of a great new venue we've got for the conference, of a fantastic partnership for this year's conference, and for a great lineup of speakers that we've got in the wings. So more details in a couple of weeks' time when we officially launch that. But I couldn't hold on to that. I just had to tell you that that is coming. Now, some of your response to the last few weeks of programming. Alain de Botton, of course, our guest last week, he was in conversation with Christian James Orr, asking, should atheists be more religious? Fascinating discussion that we had over at his house in North London. And Ian in Dundee wanted to share his appreciation. He says, a very enjoyable show, refreshing to have an atheist on who was willing to look at things in an open way rather than just being antagonistic. Naturally, I believe his plans for a temple to atheism and the like would ultimately end in failure, probably involving worshipping man, descending into new ages, and more just collapsing altogether. But it was good to hear Alain focusing on the nature of man with an honest attempt to appreciate what and who we are. Here's Ken Harvey in South Australia, I believe. Ken says, as an atheist for the last 4 years, I find myself surprisingly attracted to your style of programme and listen to every episode. I enjoyed listening to Alain de Botton's talk, but was left wondering, who's going to pay for these atheist edifices? I wouldn't contribute 1 cent to any. I'm happy to just take a walk to the nearest park or beach for contemplation. I have for quite a while suggested that airports have a room set aside where atheists can go and not pray. Interesting idea. Thank you very much, Ken. And many people getting in touch on the Facebook and Twitter account with their response to that show. And lots of people feeling it was a really valuable discussion between James and Alain de Botton last week. It's interesting to see what Alain's been making as well of the brouhaha this last week of Richard Dawkins clashing with Giles Fraser on Radio 4's Today programme. And this was after Richard Dawkins was talking about a survey they've commissioned, which appears to show that Christians aren't as Christian as they should be. That was an interesting aspect of it. One thing that came out was that Giles sort of made Richard a bit flummoxed when asked him to tell him the full title of the origin of species, which Dawkins wasn't able to do. Giles trying to make some capital of that in terms of Dawkins' suggestion that people can't call themselves Christians if they can't even name the first book of the New Testament. But anyway, interesting stuff. If that's the kind of thing you want to be kept abreast of, then do sign up for the Twitter account and the Facebook account and that sort of thing. So some more of your responses, though. Demons, still getting the responses into the episode of a few weeks ago on demonic possession. Ray says, want to express my thanks for the discussions on Unbelievable. I listen to the podcaster whenever I can. Thanks for the calm and reasoned approach to what can be pretty emotive subjects. And I sent you in a response on the subject of demons, which you read out. This discussion has continued on the Reach Out Trust forum, where both JT, who was one of our Christian guests on that program, and I post regularly. I'm a member of that forum because of my interest in Jehovah's Witnesses. I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness and was an elder for some years before leaving in 1981. I was particularly pleased to hear Jonathan Clatworthy's input into the demon discussion and feel that a vibrant liberal voice can introduce a little sanity into the debate. I know that you have liberals like Keith Ward on your program from time to time, but often it seems that the word liberal is primarily used in a pejorative way. Perhaps an examination of the rationale, methods and motivation of Christian liberals would make an interesting discussion and dispel some misrepresentations. In fact, it seems to me that the borderline between liberal and evangelical Christian scholars is, in this country, sometimes hard to define. I'd agree there, particularly with someone like Keith Ward, who does self-describe as a liberal Christian, yet in many respects could be seen as evangelical in some respects. It depends in a sense on what bits you're asking about. Doug is an atheist in Washington State. In fact, he says, I'm an anti-theistic atheist listener, not just atheist, anti-theistic atheist listener. And Doug says, usually your show provides me good examples on how to better debate believers. The show on whether or not demons exist was like an unending scratching of nails on a chalkboard. I'm sorry you had to listen to that then, Doug. You should have just switched off if it was that irritating. Demonic possession in Jesus' time clearly was simply severe mental illness manifested. For those at the time to think it was demons is understandable. For us today to think that demons were controlling a person is truly silly. If you want to think Jesus healed mental illness by casting out demons, that's your Christian prerogative. To think that demons actually exist or existed in Jesus' time, well, that's unbelievable, and only adds more weight to my understanding that the existence of any supernatural being is unlikely in the extreme, says Doug. Well, I suppose that was the whole thing we were asking on the programme, Doug, and obviously you share the view of Jonathan Clatworthy on that programme, who said it is all simply down to a misunderstanding and that sort of thing. It can all be seen in terms of mental illness, and so we obviously had that perspective on the programme. But there are these interesting stories, one of which was brought up, and I read out an interesting one last week from a listener who sent them, and things that don't, on the surface of it, necessarily seem to be necessarily explained by mental illness. Certain things that happen perhaps defy that sort of rationalisation. Anyway, thank you very much. Randy in Ontario. Randy quite often emails in. Just a quick comment this time, he says, though. I'm not sure I can completely accept what you were talking about last week, where that God wouldn't allow compelling evidence for his existence because it would undermine our free will. Now, if I were an atheist, I think I would find that explanation fairly convenient and quite weak. I would point out that Adam and Eve walked with God in the Garden of Eden and spoke directly to him. Did they not have compelling evidence of his existence, yet they still exercised their free will and disobeyed? Perhaps we should stick with what the Bible actually says, that his invisible attributes are clearly seen, so that they are without excuse. And although it may seem harsh, I find it more helpful to tell atheists that the evidence for God is abundant and irrational to deny, rather than that God chooses to hide himself to preserve our free will. Thank you for getting in touch, Randy. An interesting perspective on that question of how much evidence does God give us, and does it contravene our free will if we're overwhelmed, as it were, by the evidence for God? Neuroscience, going back to one of our earlier shows in January, says Davy George on whether neuroscience killed God, says, loving your show, me old China. I've got my four-year-old daughter and seven-year-old son hooked on it too. Are they your youngest fans? Well, certainly I've never heard of younger than that, Davy. So definitely my youngest fans. I know it's a few weeks back, but I must take umbrage at one thing your atheist neuroscientist said. He mentioned something like this. Religious people use their right brains more often. They see patterns where no patterns exist. I'm not sure, would it be left brain, actually? I can't remember now. Right or left brain, which is the creative side. Anyway, regardless of which side, whether you've said the right side there, you say, hang on a minute, mate, couldn't we just flip that statement 180 degrees? We could just as easily say that an atheist is trapped inside his own left brain and refuses to see the obvious spiritual pattern staring him in the face. So it works both ways. Thank you very much for that interaction. Finally, Scott... The Evil God Challenge, this was something we did back in December. We revisited it with Stephen Law and Glenn Peoples. Excellent podcast, actually, I was listening to this week by Glenn Peoples, where he really goes into depth on responding to the Evil God Challenge, but more depth than obviously he was able to do in the actual dialogue he had with Stephen on my show. So check out his blog, Beretta Online, I think, Beretta-online, I think, but it's called Say Hello to My Little Friend, if you want to search for that. Scott says, while I am still going through many years of podcasts after discovering your program, I wanted to pause and comment on the subject of a few of your shows and Stephen Law's Evil God Challenge. I was, at first, very taken aback by the coherence of the argument, but I wasn't really ready to accept that we could only get to God exists, but say nothing about his character. Then I remembered something C.S. Lewis had written, and it's basically stated, evil is only evil in the means, not in the ends. In other words, someone who is evil has as the end result their pleasure or power or whatever, all good to them. That would mean that someone must be harmed in order to gratify me if I am to be called evil. That raises the problem of necessity. If God is the only necessary entity, then God would have to be able to suffer to bring himself pleasure, which are self-contradicting effects. God, by definition, cannot suffer. Probably haven't had time to really elucidate that one, Scott, because we're running out of time. But an interesting perspective on the argument anyway. Thank you for emailing in. Thanks to everyone who's been in contact as well for the past few weeks of programming. Right, next week on the show, let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. We're going to be asking, do we need another translation? We're going to be joined by Joel Green, who is one of the lead translators on the Common English Bible. It came out last year, a completely new translation of the Bible. We'll be asking him, why have you brought out another translation onto an already crowded market of English translations? He'll be in conversation with David Instone Brewer, looking at some of the questions you sent in on Bible translation. Hope you can join me for that. Same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable.